Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Laura Maniak, champagne evangelist, proprietor of Cork Buzz, and a master sommelier to boot. We'll talk to Laura about champagne, wine, and Cork Buzz. We'll also taste the wine with bubbles, but not from champagne, for our weekly wine sip. Plus, Laura snuck something in. We'll drink that. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Laura Maniak has been called the it girl of the New York wine scene by the Wall Street Journal. She has won numerous awards, including Food and Wine Sommelier of the Year and Wine Enthusiast 40 Tastemakers Under 40. She received her Master Sommelier certification in 2009 and is the proprietor of three, and I just found out, soon to be four, Cork Buzz, wine studio, restaurants, retail. We'll get into all of that. There's two in New York and soon to be two in Charlotte. Cork Buzz New York City has been nominated for a 2017 James Beard Award for Outstanding Wine Program, and that's a national thing with about 20 nominees. So Laura's right in there. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Thanks, Sam. It's good to be here.
Great to have you here. Before we get into everything, I want to frame you a little and give people an idea of who you are, where you came from. So tell me about your journey in life and wine that brought you to this point.
For sure.
Cork Buzz.
Of course. Yeah, so I've always loved wine, and I've always loved the restaurant business. And I think the earliest memory is this mullet, this picture of me with a mullet. And I'm at my grandma's house, which we went to every Sunday, and I see this picture. Just the other day, my dad gave it to me, of me like navigating the wine behind the table. So I was just like really impressed by the labels and all of the, you know, imbibing that my family was doing at Sunday supper. And I think they say that I said I want to own a restaurant. And I said that because I felt like my grandma's house was a restaurant and every day felt so fun on Sundays when I was there. And I really thought that I love to take care of people, so I might as well be a restaurateur. At the time, which was like, you know, I don't know, early 2000s when I realized it would be a career, I thought I have to be a chef. I mean, chef is creative, chef is passionate, chef is like hard work, and that's some of my core values. And I decided I would go to CIA for culinary school.
You applied?
I did. I applied. I got in. I was ready to go in October.
Ready to cook?
Ready to cook. Ready to learn and cook. In 2001, so school starts in October. I take a wine class sort of by accident at Windows on the World in the World Trade Center.
With Kevin Sraley?
Actually, it was with the American Sommelier Association.
Okay.
But it was just held at Windows on the World. But obviously, Kevin is an amazing legend.
He was on a couple months ago.
Yeah, he's the best. But at the time, I took this wine class just thinking, you know, if I'm going to be a restaurant owner someday, I'm going to have to round out my knowledge. And the first day of class, I was just like, this is insane that people make money doing this. Because, you know, the guy's talking about Puligny-Montrachet and these amazing cheeses from the Loire Valley. And and you know, his travel, and he's speaking French and then Italian and English and Portuguese. And I'm like, this guy is amazing. I can't believe he gets paid to do this. So I thought, I wonder what a sommelier is, but I kind of didn't have the guts to make a career change because, I mean, I was signed up. I had a roommate. I was ready to go to Hyde Park.
Oh, you were that deep into it.
That deep. Yeah, I mean, school was supposed to start in October, and that was July. And so the class was Monday nights from 6 to 9, 103rd floor of the World Trade Center. So my last class was September 10th.
The day before 9/11?
Totally. Wow. You know, I mean, I feel so lucky. You know, I don't want to take anything away from the tragedy that happened the next day. But I feel so lucky that in a good way, because I like to look at the positive, you know, I would never have been in the wine business. Because the reason I didn't go to culinary school right after September 11th or that October was because the whole world changed. And, you know, in some ways, it's like freedom to do what your heart's pulling you to do.
You really and, focus on what's important.
Yeah.
To you.
And, you know, I lived in the East Village at the time. I mean, we saw everything happen right in, essentially before our eyes. And I was just a little shooken up and not ready. Not that it's so far in Hyde Park, but I was just like, I got to stay grounded. I'm going to stay here. So the class resumed after September 11th in the Beacon restaurant because of the affiliation.
Oh, so it wasn't done.
It wasn't done.
It happened during the, what was it, about 15, 18 weeks?
Yeah, it was an 18-week course, and let's call it we were on week 12 or something. Wow. So it was like, all right, well, I'm not going to go back to school. I'm not going to go to school just yet for culinary arts. I'll just do this wine thing, finish this certification, and who knew what was going to happen at the time, but I was working at Del Frisco's, actually. I helped open the 49th Street Del Frisco's in New York. I was working
Terry
there.
Terry Hall?
Pardon?
Was
yeah.
Terry Hall
Yeah,
there?
Totally. Yeah. And I actually just saw Felix, who is like the maitre
d' to
the stars.
I worked in the building for a lot
oh,
of
man,
years.
Oh, man, yeah. So I was, you know, I was working there September 11th, actually. What a great place that Del Frisco's is. But, yeah, and then at the time, Inez Holdernes, who is an incredible woman, was working at Windows during September 11th. She actually started working for Steve Hansen, and she opened Bluefin in the W Hotel in Times Square. Long story short, she started, and obviously, rightly so, was somewhat shooken up, and restaurant openings are just like even shake you up even crazier. And so I got hired as her assistant to go and help with the opening of Bluefin. Greg Harrington came from Vegas, from Spago, to work as the wine director for Be Our Guest.
So Bluefin is part of Steve Hansen's group. It wasn't such a group then.
Right.
Did he have the Atlantic stuff before that?
Oh, yeah.
So this was what, like his third, fourth, fifth?
No, it was like 10th.
It was
his first restaurant in a hotel. It was the first restaurant after like the Ruby Foos era.
Okay.
But yeah, anyway, so I went to be her assistant. But in February, she left and went to work at Dujac. She was just like, I need to do something different. And so she moved
to the winery.
Yeah. So she moved to Burgundy.
Wow.
And they were like,
choice, right?
Yeah, totally. I love Jeremy. And so she was like, you know, or they said, well, who knows what to do with all this wine? And it was, you know, 2001 and Times Square. So super busy. And so I just kind of by default become the sommelier there. And I'm 21 and I'm running a, you know, $35 million a year restaurant, wow, wine program with, you know, another sommelier, this guy Paolo, who's great as well. And yeah, long story short, I ended up working for Hansen for 10 years.
You became the
wine director. Yeah.
You were managing how many restaurants?
At the time, he had 25 and then two hotels. So I helped him build the hotel brand, the James.
And you're talking tens of millions in retail and wholesale sales passing through.
Yeah. I remember somebody said to me once, you can make a pallet of Prosecco, you know, disappear in a week because we would buy, you know, 10 cases for Blue Water, 10 for Bluefin, this and that. So it was an important job. I mean, it was one of the few wine director positions in New York City. And it was a ton of fun. I made partner with him right before he sold the company to Starwood Capital Group. So I helped with the, you know, PricewaterhouseCoopers, you know, that valuation. And it was a really successful sale for him. And it was great to be a partner. And, you know, we made some money. I bought an apartment and saved a bunch. And then I was able to open CorkBuzz years later.
So was that the natural ending with Hansen for you in a way? Because all that stuff happened and there was a change?
It was. And it wasn't because of the change. Because
were you ready in your mind?
I was
to move
ready.
On?
So I passed in 2009. I left in 2010. And I started my company in 2011. Well, I opened in 2011.
Did you know then what you wanted to do, or you were playing around with multiple ideas?
No, I really wasn't playing around with any other ideas. I thought that I wanted to do my own thing. And I did think that I wanted to do something that hadn't been done in New York at the time, which was to open a wine school. That was originally the plan. It was only wine classes in the very beginning. It was just going to be... Why we called it a wine studio, or why we still do, is because I was inspired by, you know, a gym or a yoga studio that you drop in for classes that you are interested in and times that work for you. And at the time in New York, it was just like, if you wanted to take a wine class, it was 18 weeks, Monday nights, Wednesday nights, whatever the program was, which is a great way to experience an education in wine. However, busy New Yorkers, sometimes they just want a date night. Sometimes right. They wanted consumer.
New Yorkers have a low attention span. Give
totally.
It to me now. Let's go.
Yeah.
We'll come back a little later and we'll talk about Cork Buzz.
Okay,
you
great.
Know, and the whole wine education thing and, you know, your mission and all of that. But while I have you here, I want to tap into you on your expertise and, you know, what you've noticed has been going on. One of your true loves and passions is certainly champagne.
Absolutely.
I mean, you are a bona fide expert. So get me up to speed about what's happening, trending in champagne. Not just the region, but, you know.
In general.
Yeah.
Consumption. And
yeah. I mean, what's going on? What's different now than when you opened up? What's, you know,
great.
Hot and trending now?
Yeah, you know, I think everything goes through phases. And I mean, certainly about 5 years ago was the extra brut or the zero dosage phase.
Dosage being the sugar that they add.
Right.
So you're talking about no added sugar, drier.
Right.
That was a trend?
That was definitely a trend.
Okay.
And so if you see the term zero dosage, as you know, or brut sauvage.
Means very dry.
Totally dry. And those were really good. And I think the sommeliers were really like obsessed with that style. I'm more of the, I like wines that are balanced no matter what they are. So some zero dosage can be like so austere, so gripping and racy, and others can be really well rounded in their fruit. And so without sugar, it's fine. So we're starting to go away from just like terms and being, I only buy zero dosage. And I think we're returning back to champagne as a wine. And it's so exciting to see because I've always thought, you know, champagne is more than aperitif and oysters. Champagne is...
Or celebratory.
Totally.
Yeah.
Or wedding cake. I mean, that's the only thing I won't drink champagne with.
That's the problem. People perceive it as one way. I can't get enough champagne people on the show. I've had Alice Payard on.
Oh, nice.
I had David White just wrote a book about champagne.
Amazing book.
You know, you're on. I'm twisting Peter Liam's arm.
Oh, good.
You know, because I think champagne is, it's not underrated. It's just people don't think of it.
Yeah.
And you featured heavily. So the dosage thing.
It was. Now it's not as much.
So what does that mean? That champagnes are in the market where, or people are presenting champagnes where there's a little added sugar, or it's not that important?
I think it's just everything now, whereas before the most exciting things to people were the zeros.
Right.
And I think, you know, champagne, there's a whole idea of grower champagne.
Well, I wanted to ask you, tell people what a grower champagne is.
So there's a distinction where you can be a récoltant manipulant, so an RM letter on a bottle would just mean that the person who's bottling it also grew the grapes. Everything is in his or her control. So
you would equate that to an estate-grown wine.
Absolutely.
The property is yours. You vint it. You're not contracting.
Exactly.
It's your style.
Exactly. And a lot of times, you know, since Champagne is such a large region and it is the art of the blend, this is a little bit more site-specific. So if you're a grower, producer, a farmer, fizz, you know, you can use any of those names. You might have a little piece of property in Avis in the south of Champagne in the Côte de Blanc. So if you only have that soil and you only grow those grapes, then that's a very specific style of champagne. Whereas the Grand Marques or the larger houses would say, okay, great, we have some property, but we also buy grapes. So that's the difference. A grower...
So would you say they establish a house style and consistently they get close to it every year?
I would say so. And I think one can't exist without the other. I mean, they're both unbelievable if you're talking about the best in their class. So I'm sure that there are growers that don't have the expertise or don't have the money or don't know what the consumers want, and maybe they're not as good. And then there's large houses that maybe their reputation has always been good, but maybe their quality is not as good as it used to be. Or, you know, you can make a point that one is better than the other, but I really think that they're both so important. And I feature both growers and small production champagne houses, and I also love the tried and true and the brands that, you know, our consumers would ask for.
So grower's been a hot term for years.
Yeah.
I mean, growers have been growing grower champagne for a long time.
Totally.
You know, recently it's been a preference. I'm just curious, how many grower champagne makers are there? Is it hundreds?
No, there's like tens of thousands. I mean,
there's that many?
I think the number I've heard last was there are 20,000, you know, growers.
And these are all obviously in the region of Champagne.
Right. Not all of them bottle their own wine.
Right.
Some people just grow grapes.
Now, is most of it good or like anything, some of it is shit?
Yeah. I mean, some of it's not as good.
Right.
But listen, you're talking about champagne. I mean, and it's hard to ask me because I think champagne is just great,
like,
no matter what.
Bad champagne's better than a cold Coca-Cola any day or whatever.
Yeah.
All right, so let's tap into you a little more. Talk to me about some of your favorites.
Okay.
At every range of the spectrum.
Perfect.
And then talk to me about some good value champagnes.
Sounds good.
Like Jake, my son, is sitting here. He's going to go to a party and bring a couple of bottles. He ain't spending more than $40-$50. So we want to get there. So let's talk about favorites,
okay,
any range, and let's talk about some values.
Okay. So for the Grand Marks, the larger houses that are still, I think, the best of the best, you have Champagne Ruinard. And I love Ruinard. I think they're
one of the oldest.
One of the oldest to make intentional sparkling. And their caves are so deep. Like, they have these cryères that just go, you know, 80 meters down.
Wow.
Insane visit. One
Can
of the
you
best.
You visit?
Oh, yeah.
It's open to the public?
I think you have to make an appointment. But still, yeah.
But it's a sight to be seen, the caves.
I'm telling you, I haven't been that impressed by a winery visit in God knows how long.
Wow.
It's so incredible. You see these little etchings in the cryère of, like, you know, people during World War II making little places to pray.
Wow.
And you think about the entire city of Rennes being inverted in these caves. So, you know, if it was bombing upstairs above ground, you have these caves where people were safe and they went to school down there. And it just gives me the chills thinking about the history.
It's more than just the wine.
It's
the whole history.
It's the history. Every world war.
So Ruinart is Ruinart.
Yes.
Expensive, and right?
I think it's, you know, qualitative price for value is there.
Okay.
I mean, listen, it's not $25
no,
champagne.
No, and I'm not talking about that.
Yeah.
Because you can get sparkling wine for that price. Champagne
exactly.
definitely starts higher. So there's some reasonable range for that.
Exactly.
What else?
Well, so there's a grower producer. He started off as a grower, which is interesting, but now he's also buying grapes. And his Raphael Bereche.
B-E-R-E-C-H-E?
Yes.
Okay.
So Bereche family is another incredible property. It's in the region of Lude, which is technically in the Montagne de Reims, and he's doing so many cool, like, single parcel sites. But his entry level, like Vallée de la Marne, is so good. And most recently,
how many champagnes is he making?
I think he's up to, you know, close to 20 different.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So he has Beauregard and he has L'Enfant, but I just think his Vallée de la Marne cuvée is delicious. And what a, like, great guy. I was tasting with him and his son about 3 weeks ago when we visited Champagne in Paris, and it was just, like, the most incredible thing. You're seeing this dad teaching his son, who's
cool.
seven, you know. He said to him, like, grab this black glass and tell me what you smell in the wine. He didn't taste it, but he just smelled it, and he goes, like, oh, raisin, like raisins. And I was like, good, kid. It smells like grapes. You're
That's
right.
Great.
So cool.
You neglected to mention earlier that when you left Steve Hansen and before you opened Cork Buzz, didn't you go to Champagne?
I did.
Did you work a harvest?
2010 harvest, and I did a lot of the Cocard, which is the press that they use. So I worked in the press house, and I worked in the vineyards.
Did you work at...
I worked at La Hert.
Laird.
Yeah, okay. So again, in right outside of Epernay.
You just thought, listen, I have this break in time here. Let me go.
Exactly. And most restaurants, when I was with Hansen, they opened in September, which is the Vendage or the Harvest.
Right.
So it was like the only free time I ever had to work Harvest.
Great. You'll never regret doing
that. Oh, no.
All right, so give me a couple of great value champagnes. What's rocking for the low end of the price spectrum?
There is Champagne Roederer, and their Brut Premier is delicious. I think, you know, you can bring that to a party, Jake.
You'll love it. Big house.
Yeah,
okay.
it's a great house, and they're doing some experiments with biodynamics, so they're cool. Let's see. I love Marie Noëlla Drew, although it's not like super value, but I think
so. Marie Noëllat.
No, it's Noelle, and then the second name is Ledru.
Ledru.
Marie Noëlla Ledru.
And that's a good quality, good value.
Great quality Ambonnet. So she's in one of the riper regions. Let's see what else.
One more.
It's always like when you're on the spot, you're just like racking your brain of your favorites.
It's all right if you can't think of one. All right, you think of this.
We'll go back.
Let me ask you this. You would know this better than anyone. Tell me the best way to serve champagne. Tell me temperature. Tell me glasses. You know, everyone's stuck on flutes. That could be bullshit, I think.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be. So tell me, you know, you don't want it too cold.
Nope.
Some people don't mind it warm because the flavors come out. But what's ideal?
So I would say I love serving champagne in white wine glasses. That's ideal
okay.
to me. If it's a
big, more open.
Yeah, more than the narrow flute. And
right.
the narrow flute traps and lets the bubbles be expressed. But you don't really get the aroma because the bubbles will go through your nose and
right.
can't really smell them that way. So I think a white wine glass is perfect. If it's a richer style, like vintage and or if it has oak or if it is like a really ripe village, something that
then
really...
What?
Then I would use a white burgundy glass or
okay.
a burgundy
so
glass.
A white wine or a white burgundy.
Yeah.
So burgundy, which is a fine wine, you use it for the vintage, better ones.
Correct.
Every day you're better off using a white wine glass, screw the flute
yeah.
type thing. Now tell me about temperature.
So temperature, I'm in the like 48 to 52 range.
So a refrigerator's colder, you can refrigerate it, let it sit
exactly.
for a little and...
Exactly. If you have storage, you probably keep your cellar at 56
right.
degrees, give or take.
If you have a little closet, you could
yeah.
set it to that,
exactly.
the white wine setting and all of that. All right. What we talked about this earlier, what other wines and wine regions, and you can go anywhere, are exciting you right now?
Sounds good. I'm obsessed with the Alto Piedmont, the High Piedmont, so just above Barolo.
There's a difference between Piedmont and Alta Piedmont?
I think
is that like the hills?
Yeah, it's the northern part just above Barolo Barbaresco. So there's regions that, like Gamay or Gattinara, they're two regions. And I just recently attended a seminar of amazing wines from Alto Piedmont. So if you love Barolo but you don't want to spend $100 in a restaurant plus, I think Piedmont, from the northern part of Piedmont, is a great value wine region.
So
same grape.
I should know this, and I don't. So because I don't, that means my listeners probably don't. So Piedmont is famous for Barolos, Barbarescas, Albizastis, and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
The Alta Piedmont, are they making Barolos and Barbarescas, or are they growing a different grape, or both?
So the grape in Barolo Barbaresco that everyone knows and loves is called Nebbiolo.
Right.
And
Tuscany, Sangiovese. So Nebbiolo is
exactly
you know,
in that region.
Right.
So Nebbiolo is the grape of choice in Alto or
okay.
High Piedmont. Yes.
Got it.
So same grape, but of course they can't call it Barolo because they're not in the geographical
like champagne.
Boundaries. Exactly.
Give me a couple of people that are doing it well in Alta Piedmont.
So Nervi. I love Nervi.
N-E-R-V-I?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And then Iopo, which is the producer I just brought you
right.
for Rosé. So we're going to drink Nebbiolo Rosé today.
That's great.
Bringing in the spring.
Do they tend to be a little less money or not necessarily?
Absolutely.
So there's a value there.
Incredible value.
Now, stylistically, differences?
Yeah. A little lighter than Barolo Barbaresco. Some different soil types in the north, so you have a little bit more sand. They tend to be more soft, a little more perfumed, a little more alpine in the acidity. So that just means, like, if you like the rustic, bigger style of truffles and rose petals that you get in Barolo. This might be a little more, you know, pine or tar, but in a softer way.
So don't drink it thinking it's going to be a Barolo. Be open to the fact that same region, same grape, little different style.
Little different,
right?
Yeah.
Like you said, if you want the rose petals, that classic stuff, you could buy the Give Me Something Else that's exciting to you.
I'm excited by Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, and their wines. I really love them.
I was at the Raw Wine Festival and tasted a bunch of wines.
Yeah, so I like the
Tell me why. I mean, what are they doing?
Well, I mean,
Georgia and Russia, right? Or the
Well, for me, in this case, I'm talking about the wines from Georgia and the Republic of Georgia. They've been making wine since, I don't know, before.
In amphoras.
Yeah, well, an amphora, which they call Quevri. And they're making everything from some sparkling, although I haven't had that many, all the way through light whites that are fresh. Then this orange style, which a lot of people, it's very... it's a conversation piece that a lot of guests are coming in and asking about. But these orange wines have like almost like a tea-like tannin, and they have just so much complexity. And they're really great for the table. And it's an exciting food and wine pairing with these orange wines. Then they make lighter reds, and then they make fuller reds. Of course, they make dessert styles. But I think they're...
Are they accessible and available?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, bigger, better wine stores, certainly in New York City. Restaurants are starting to carry them.
Yeah, I would say that right now we're about to add a rosé from Georgia. We have a red by the glass, and we have a white by the glass. So it's a very important region to look for.
That's great. Give me something, or can you give me something domestic?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've always been a huge fan of Napa and Sonoma, and I'm getting married in November, and I chose Napa because so many places that are just so important to me in my memory of Napa, and I've been there 3 times in the past month. I'm, you know, not afraid to say that I love domestic wine, you know.
So what do you like in Napa? There's been, you know, the argument. I had Jasmine Hirsch on. She had In Pursuit of Balance.
Yep.
You know, toned down Pinot Noirs. There's all the cult wines.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole range. What do you like?
I'm in the middle. Yeah. Like, I'm Kathy Corison all the way. I love Corison wines. I love Maya Kamas. I'm, you know, I like the guys that are doing it and are established, but are always willing to just, you know, check in with themselves and try new things. But... So, I mean, Robert Sinsky Vineyards.
He's one of the few biodynamic.
Chapelet. I mean, these guys are just so established. They've been making wine there since the 80s.
That's true.
Or 70s in some cases.
Which is a long time for Napa.
Yeah. And, you know, listen, I am really good friends with Carissa Mondavi, and I love her. I don't think there's like... She's like her grandpa. You know, she's so generous and so...
Passionate
and so humble. And, I mean, Continuum, when, you know, her and her father and her brother started that winery. I mean, they have so much history and know Napa, like, literally, the back of their hand. And yet, they're still, you know, working the market and never taking their reputation and just, like, doing, you know, dialing it in.
A whole new generation, different projects.
Yeah.
Different perspective and all of that. How about Sonoma?
I love Sonoma, too.
What do you like there?
Well, you mentioned Jasmine, and obviously her wines are beautiful. Hirsch. I really like, you know, Linmar, which is in Russian River. I mean,
beautiful.
One of my favorite people, period, in the world is Joy Sterling. So, I mean, Iron Horse, you talk about domestic sparkling wine.
I was going to say, Iron Horse is a big sparkling house.
So good. I had their 91 Joy the other day out of Magnum, and I was like, this is like as good as champagne.
They're making good stuff
Incredible. Consistently.
Schramsberg. Amazing. We're going to taste the Schramsberg. So Iron Horse... At a Sonoma is a great sparkling wine house. I'm glad to hear that from
you. It's such a beautiful place to visit, too.
All right. So we're going to move on to Cork Buzz, which is a very important part of your life and consumes a lot of your time. So you talked about how you left working with Steve Hansen, the Big B, our guest restaurant group, took a little time off. You did the harvest in Napa. And you must have been plotting in your mind. Things started getting specific. Take me from that point on, how everything came about.
Great. So my uncle is my business partner now and was when we started the company. His name is Frank. So I don't call him uncle because it's just too long. So Frank and I decided to become partners. But after I came to him and said, I'm getting ready to leave the company, be our guest.
You pitched him, sort of.
Yeah, and I wasn't pitching him to be my partner. He was a retired software guy, And he sucked at retiring. I mean, he just, like, couldn't stop working. Actually, I think he's calling me now because he wants to chat about our business. But
Frank, we're on the air.
Hi, Frank. We can't pick up. Anyway, so he was just as smart and successful in business and a mentor to me. So I said, hey, I'm looking to start my own company. Can I bounce some ideas off of you? I went to his apartment in Chelsea, and he said, okay, sure. He basically took notes for me. I wrote my business plan by just dictating to him my ideas. And about halfway through the business plan, he was like, this is a really great concept, and I'm really bad at retiring, and I think I can add value, and I can show you how to start a company and how to run one from a business standpoint. Obviously, you know, the restaurants and the wine start part of it. And so that's, you know, that's how we started. And I mean,
open arms right away. It sounded
just
good.
Yeah, it was just like, you know what? I have money. He wanted to invest. I have my own investment. We'll raise some outside money just because we think that's important. And we created a business plan. We started looking at real estate in New York. We found our location on 13th between 5th and University. Which,
did you have a neighborhood in mind or the best value?
I mean,
did you want to be downtown?
I wanted to be in Union Square.
You did. Okay, so you.
Yeah, I really did. And you know, we built the place from a paper store. I mean, it wasn't an existing restaurant, so we did everything from the fit and finish and plumbing and electrical.
I remember going in there right after you opened, and we were talking. You didn't really know me then, but you said you and Frank were stapling the fabrics on the back of the bolsters.
I did, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
talk about jumping into the whole thing.
The whole thing.
So you open up when?
We opened November 29th, 2011. So it just turned 5.
And you mentioned earlier, and this is a big part, that wine education was really an important aspect or the backdrop for this. So talk to me about that.
So the original business plan says we'll do classes, we'll host wine events, we'll do wine dinners. It'll be that, like we just talked about. And we started looking at real estate and the value pricing, you know, in New York City. And we were like, wait a minute. We can't just open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for these classes and then close. And, you know, also it didn't really fit the brand because the brand is about empowering people. And it's about come on in, learn about wine. And if I teach people about, let's just say, Nervi and Gattinara and these Piedmont producers, and then I'm like, okay, well, class is over. Go find a glass of wine with your friends somewhere else. So
back up for a second because I'm not confused, but I just want to clarify. The original idea was not to open what it is now, but some kind of wine education space. And as you said, it evolved to all these things so you could serve people that way.
Right. So imagine that the original business plan was just we open for classes and we close as soon as the classes are done.
You lose everyone for food and you know other drinks and all.
So the restaurant or the wine bar piece was part of the education. It came after. So yes, we will teach you about wine and then you can just have wine and food as well. So now that's a large part of our business.
So in going in there and reading stuff, you use the words approachable and never intimidating.
Right.
Which is sort of what this show is. We're not talking to the industry. We're not talking to other somms. If people could walk away with something today, they'll go and try an Alta Piedmont wine.
I love it.
One of your champagnes. And I think that's somewhat of your approach. Even though you get professionals in there, how do you approach that? I mean, what is approachable and never intimidating? What do you mean by that?
I think you're right. It's wine for the people, for everyone. And I mean, we could have created an industry hangout, but you know, everybody's busy working in the industry. It means the neighbors that don't know anything about wine and they are saying, I'll have Pinot Grigio, or do you know of anything that's like Pinot Grigio? And you just like, of course we do. And you're enthusiastic and you pour three different wines. And, you know, wine bars are great because you have so many wines by the glass. So you really can teach
someone.
How
many wines by the glass are you running on an average?
Right now it's about 45 to 50. And, you know, so you have all of these styles and you're able to really just sit with someone, even if it's 5 minutes, and say, try this wine. I mean, last night I must have tried one of our guests in the snowstorm on, you know, six
you
different red wines.
Night? There was a big snowstorm in New York.
Yeah, I just like shoveled the path and opened.
Good place to come.
Why not? Nothing else is open. So, yeah. So, you know, I mean, you just try people on wines and you show them by example.
Do most people come in? I know people come in after work, happy hour, drink.
Yep.
They're coming and going. And some people come in because they know what you're doing.
Right.
They leave it to you, right? So that's where you'll turn people on to different things. Do you consult people? What do you like? What do you
look? Of course. You know, my thing would never, I would never be successful if it was all about me. It's really about my staff too. I mean, my time is spent helping my team understand what does it mean to be an approachable place that people could ask any question and it's not stupid. And you can just really show them if they're like, haven't had orange wine, you could have a flight called Orange is the New Rosé. And, you know, that's what we do. And so it's somewhat subtle education. But my staff is really all about it, too. So they'll be more than happy to just say, you don't know the difference between Albarino and Gruner. How about we try them both?
People
it's
are...
simple as that.
That's crazy. I had Pascaline.
Yeah, Peltier, she's so good.
She said you helped her with her, you know, MS.
That's really nice.
So I mean, tell people quickly what a MS is. It's a master sommelier. We've talked about it on the show over and over.
Sure.
We did with Pascaline. But, you know, in order to achieve that, mm-hmm. tell people what you had to do.
So you pass a series of exams, and the master's exam is invitation only once a year. And you have a blind tasting, you have a theory paper, which is a verbal exam, and you have this practical or service portion. So what you have to do is be an expert at beer, sake, wine, spirits,
all
cocktails.
All beverages?
Anything you can pour. We joke around and say even like coffee, water.
Wow.
But, you know, it's
and it's easy. It only took you how many years to pass?
6 years.
6 years. It's one of the most difficult tests, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and it really, for wine, it just makes you keep getting better and better. So for me, I only did it as a personal goal because I wanted to be an expert at the thing I love the most.
But you got it back in 2009, right?
Yeah, it was quite a while ago. So it's 7 years.
You've been carrying that for a long time. Does that help you with the wine education? I mean,
I think it's definitely good for credibility. I mean, if people meet me and they're like, "Oh, you look young still," and that's really good, and then they're like, "Wait, you're a master sommelier?" So it's a really great point of people taking what you're doing seriously. You know, I don't think that you need to be a master sommelier in order to be successful. I mean,
right.
I have a high regard for
you. Were
so
driven
many.
To do it.
Yeah.
There are people that are very well informed that are not MSs.
Absolutely. Or MW is another
right.
great, but it's the highest accreditation.
There's different certifications. So you open the Cork Buzz in Union Square on 13th Street, but it doesn't end there.
No.
Tell me what happens. You get an itch, you get a bug.
I was definitely always going to open more than one, and anywhere that we felt like it would be helpful to guests to, you know, have this wine education space. Chelsea Market, which is the iconic, you know, New York institution. It was the old Nabisco factory in Chelsea. So they approached us. They said, we want to open a wine
really?
Bar in Chelsea Market. And they came in a lot and they loved our food and they really liked the approachability. And so they asked us to open a small, like, I mean, it's a jewel box, like a teeny space inside of Chelsea Market. So we
turned
did that.
Turned out to be a good location for you.
It's amazing.
Great.
What a great collection of other stores are in that market.
Yeah.
I mean,
the
it's New York.
Food and
it's
everything.
It's so good.
Yeah. There's also a good wine store in there, too.
I love Chelsea Wine Vault.
So you opened that. You opened that what year?
2014 with Missy Robbins, actually.
Oh, you did?
She was our opening chef.
So Missy Robbins is like a food Lauren.
Missy is.
She's probably one of the hottest, best, most passionate restaurateurs. She has
is.
Lily in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. She just got the James Beard.
So Missy's finals. A partner with you.
No, she or was. No. She wasn't a partner. She is a really dear friend. She was getting ready to open her place, so she had the summer
she
to be creative
you.
And free, and
cool.
so we hired her as a consultant, and she helped us with the opening.
Great. So for some crazy reason, you have to explain this, you continue to expand. You open up in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Right. Well, that's where Frank is.
You're
current.
A latent Panthers fan or something? Wait, what about Frank?
So Frank is currently living in Charlotte. So his family, which is my cousins and my aunt, They went to school there, well, not my aunt, my cousins, and he built a house there to be close to his kids and his grandchildren. And when we would go there for holidays, we're like, wow, this could use
a
Cork
market.
Buzz. It could really use
very
a Cork
upscale,
Buzz.
Very upscale, very hip.
Second largest banking city.
Right.
A lot of our banking clients.
Banking center.
They're
yeah.
there. So It was a natural fit. The rent is much less expensive than New York and all of the operating expenses. But, you know, I think why we wanted to be there is it's an emerging food scene. You know, that whole area is really blowing up. And I think we could be one of the first to do this wine education and high quality food and wine exciting events and classes. So we did. And we opened there to it'll be 2 years in July.
That's great.
Yeah.
Now, when you look around, you know, I've been in New York my whole life. I don't think there's a lot of people doing what you're doing.
That's exciting. Thank you for saying that.
I mean,
that.
there are places that do classes. Mm-hmm. There are restaurants. But I think you wrap it around all together.
Thank you.
Do you feel that you're not exclusive in the category, but you're at the top of the heap? I mean,
yeah. I think, like you said earlier about, you know, we're wine for the people. So, I mean, we are the go-to place for a lot of gifts and wine classes, and people want to create something. People want experiences. You know, they don't just want to go eat and drink. So even our wine, like our corporate events, you know, you want to do a blind tasting, team building exercise. People come to
wrap
us
wrap it
for
around
that.
Wine.
So that we are unique in that way.
And you did say something earlier. I mean, if you go on your website, there is, you know, a list of past classes. The classes are usually what, one night, multiple nights? There's an outline. You're pretty thorough. Typical New Yorkers.
Exactly.
Get it to me.
Yeah, we have an hour and a half class. Usually it's a subject, but you don't have to take one every week, but there are always Monday classes, Wednesdays, Saturday,
not,
Sunday.
It's your choice to do it, which is the best way to do that. I'm always curious about this, about women and wine.
Yes.
We've had a lot of women and wine on the show, you know, some of the best people in the business. Why do you think it's taken so long for women to become, you know, more prominent? If you look in New York and you look at winemakers, it's starting to really happen. Is it the obvious reason?
I think, you know, historically, the sommelier job was definitely more of a man's job, and the restaurant business can be hard. It doesn't have to
be. It's like banking. It's the way it was.
It's just the way it was, and it just took a while to climb to the top of the heap.
You needed some tenacious people early on.
It's true. And, you know, I have to say, in New York, you would expect, like, the men to be, like, cutthroat and, you know, just not welcoming. I never had that experience. I was very lucky. I have a lot of very generous people and mentors and people, you know, you think about the industry. And New York is actually very collaborative.
Yeah.
So
it was
lucky.
Never gender competitive.
Not for me.
People embraced each other as a community.
Yeah.
So New York is a good market for that. I would guess most big markets, Chicago, L.A., Charlotte.
Yes.
I mean, I would think so. All right, we're going to break in a couple of minutes, but I have a couple more questions I wanted to ask you about. I wanted to get your take on the organic, biodynamic, natural wine movement, mm-hmm. which is... You mentioned orange wine, which is always... And I wanted to talk to you a little about social media. So give me your take on biodynamic, organic, natural wines in the sense of, has it been a trend for a bunch of years? Has it always been there? I mean, do you... More people ask for it? You serve more? I bet if I interviewed you 6 years ago, you wouldn't be talking about orange wine, or maybe.
That's true. No, you're right. I mean, I definitely think that the conversation has moved towards natural wine and organics and biodynamics, that people have a desire to know that they're doing the best they can for the environment, for the future. And
the sustainability aspect.
Exactly. And you know, I think Pascaline probably did talk about it, and she is a pioneer in New York, and she's certainly moving the needle in terms of, you know, only having that style
of
wine.
That's one choice.
And so is Wild Air, which are great places that I'm, you know, I love going to. You know, I've never been all natural, only natural. That's not really my style in general. While I appreciate it, I also like, you know, for winemakers to intervene when they need to. And my list is not organized at that.
A high percentage of your wines are traditional versus
farmed.
Esoteric, right?
Yes. And that's, you know,
no poo-poo to that.
No. Everybody to each his own, you know, and everybody has to do what they believe is right for their business or for themselves. So, I mean, I really, really love the idea that we're going to leave the earth hopefully better for our next generation. So, I mean, however we can be sustainable is important to me. And but
people have been practicing it for a long time and not necessarily carrying the monikers,
correct,
you know, with them. I mean, in Europe, Italy, France, for sure.
Right.
So you have everything.
I have
everything. You have the traditional wines. Like you said, yeah, have the orange wines. All right, jump to social media. Social media didn't really exist much in the wine world not that many years ago. It's escalated. How has it changed you, your business, wine?
It's
a good thing, right?
It's incredible.
Are you a heavy user?
I love it. Yeah. So Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You know, I think that people want to know what's going on. And I'm lucky that we have, you know, a lot of followers, both personally and as well as our businesses. And I think that we can really, like, excite people via social media. If they have not come to Cork Buzz, you can show them what's going on, what winemakers are in town. I mean, it's really
great marketing tool.
The quickest way to communicate all of the exciting things that are literally happening so fast. So I think it's as important as email blasts.
Right.
And to keep your guest engaged with the brand is, I think, why people are loyal to us, because they feel like they're part of the conversation and they're not just coming in once a week. They kind of hear these mini messages, and we try not to just make them commercials for whatever we want people to buy. We try to, like, teach via social media too. So sometimes it's just like an article about this property and why we think it's special. So
I use it for discovery.
Yeah.
I mean, for you to use it for marketing, and I'm sure you do what I do. I'm just curious, you know, what's Laura talking about? Where's she been? If she went to a tasting, you know, you usually point out what you like.
Yep.
You'll see a trend and all that. There's a lot of discovery. I think it's very positive. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to subject you to our wine list, which is a bunch of questions. And then we're going to taste a couple of wines on there. We're going to pop and screw some corks. All right? So we'll be right back. We're with Laura Maniac from Cork Buzz.
Today's program is brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, period. Why? Lush grasslands, glacial water supply, fourth generation cheesemakers, combining old world tradition with the new ideas and highest standards. The very best milk. What do you think of when you think of Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds, delicious fresh cheese curds, or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Upland's Cheese Company, the operation behind the Pleasant Ridge Reserve cheese that's literally America's most awarded cheese. I think of the deliciously stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think about Raleigh's Dumbarton Blue, a perfect blend of English-style cheddar and notes of blue. I think of Emmy Roth's Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Champion at the World Championship Cheese Contest. Wisconsin is like the world champion of cheese, and once you start reading the list of cheeses made in Wisconsin on their website, you can see why. The Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board is a nonprofit organization funded entirely by Wisconsin's dairy farm families. Read more at eatwisconsincheese.com. And as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, eat Wisconsin cheese. It's a no-brainer.
All right, we're back with Laura Maniac. Laura, am I saying your name right?
You know, it's so funny. I'm about to give that name up, but it's Manic.
But is it Manic?
You know what, though?
I, like, knew that.
No, it's so
That's
funny.
That's why I asked
The
you.
Reason I don't care is because I, like, so many people have been calling me Maniac or Maniac.
Well, that's
or,
sort of a natural,
so,
like, fun thing.
But exactly. So I just, like, really just, like, yeah, I just go with it all.
Laura, like Laura mentioned earlier, she's getting married in November, right?
Woo.
So you're going to drop the name?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah.
All right, Laura, I want to subject you to our wine list. It's a list of questions, and normally we do one version. I want to do a special version with you. I want to do the wine and champagne version. So every question is going to require probably two answers.
Okay.
Nothing too crazy. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What wines are you trying that you've drank, you know, over and over? Is it seasonal?
I'm drinking orange wine.
Okay.
I'm drinking Georgian wine. I love Grüner Veltliner from Austria.
Okay.
So I'm drinking lots of Grüner, all different styles.
Okay, so Grüner, orange, and Georgian wine. Now, champagne. Are you trying anything? Are there any areas, producers, growers?
Yes. I love the Aube, which is...
What is that?
It's A-U-B-E.
That's a region in France?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's the southernmost region, and it is most of the time Pinot Noir. However,
100% Pinot a lot?
Right.
Okay.
And it's one of the few regions in Champagne where it's very much about organics and biodynamics, just because they don't have the pest issues that they have in the north.
Give me a producer. That's good.
Let's see. I like Marie Courtin.
Spell the last name.
C-O-U-R-T-I-N. Marie Courtin is really good, but there's so many. If you want a larger producer to try from the Aube, you can try Drapier.
Drapier is very
so good.
All right, let's keep moving. Favorite wine and food pairing, favorite wine and champagne pairing. Let's start with favorite wine and food pairing.
Okay.
You personally.
So I really like these ideas of flavors that marry in the wine and in the food. So we had this Moroccan red wine by the glass, and we have this lamb with apricot and harissa, which is this spice. And, I mean, this wine, it's a grape that you probably have not heard of, Arianoa. So it's a really cool wine, and it has a lot of this exotic flavors and Moroccan spices.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, you'll have to come try it.
All right, now give me a champagne.
Anything fried in champagne. I mean, the bubbles cut through the salt and the acid and... in the champagne makes like anything fried taste like really refreshed. So
a couple of people, guests have said fried chicken.
Fried chicken. You know, I'm just like simple, so I'll do French fries and Blanc de Blanc champagne.
So it's a perfect foil for
that. Perfect.
All right. Give me, besides Cork Buzz, and I guess this is an admiration question, your favorite wine restaurant and or wine bar. Let's just do New York. I mean, who do you admire?
I love Gramercy Tavern. I think it's what I aspire to be and my inspiration for Cork Buzz. But I love Rouge Tomat. I think they're doing a great job. So
Gramercy Tavern is a full-blown restaurant with an amazing wine program. Rouge is similar to that.
Yes.
But it's a little more restricted, the menu.
Yes.
And the wine, like you said, is a lot of natural and Chenin and all of
correct.
That. So those are two good ones. Favorite all-time wine? Something
ooh.
That moved you, that's memorable, could be a birth year. Can
I know
you think
it.
Of one?
Yes.
You do?
Definitely.
Wow. A lot of people toil over this one.
Well, I'm... Ravino, which is a Chablis producer that I love. I remember drinking the Lake Clos, the Grand Cru of Lake Clos.
You have a year?
Yeah, I love the 1999. So I remember that wine like
Ravino,
it was yesterday.
Ravino, 1999 Lake Clos.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good choice. All right. You definitely can help me here. Best wine, this goes back to Jake again, best wine under $15 or around $15, recommend a red to me and recommend a white.
You need producer name too.
You can go category if you
okay,
can give
we'll
me
get,
a producer.
We'll get there. Yeah. So I would say Grüner Veltliner is always a great value
from white, Austria.
White wine under $15. I like this producer called Wimmer Czerny, which is like Wimmer. Czerny. Good mouthful there. And for reds, I mean, you know, I think you can't go wrong with Sangiovese from, you know, Tuscany and as
can
a category.
You get $15 Sangiovese?
Yeah. I mean,
are they Rosso di Montalcino?
I think you could do Chianti Classico or Rosso di Montalcino. You know, I really like producers like Badia Cotobono. Maybe it's a little more than 15.
Maybe 18 bucks.
Yeah,
or
but
something.
Still, it's like,
on the lower end of that.
And you can find it.
Yeah. Accessibility is important. So those are two good ones. All right, last one. Give me, I guess I'll narrow this. Give me your best grower champagne.
I think it's Raphael Beresh.
Beresh, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I really like Savart too, S-A-V-A-R-T. I forgot that was the one I was thinking of. And there's another producer called Kalsac. C-A-L-S-A-C.
Okay.
All three of those are really great value champagne.
Great. All right, so that's our wine list. You did an admirable job. You moved quickly. You were very specific. Now we're going to move to our weekly wine sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air.
Great.
For our weekly wine sip this week, I brought in a wine and Laura brought in a wine. I brought in a sparkler from Napa Valley, the 2009 Schramsberg Brut Rosé. It's 70% Pinot Noir, 30% Chardonnay, available at better wine stores. You can get this vintage and current vintages. I think it's around 35, 45 bucks. Laura, you brought in...
I brought in IOPPA, which is I-O-P-P-A. I brought their Rosé of Nebbiolo 2016, which is from Piedmont in Italy.
Okay, so we'll try both of them. Let's talk about the champagne first. Schramsberg, pretty good producer.
Love it. Very
okay.
iconic.
And the IOPPA is small,
for me,
large?
For me, it was brand new. I hadn't heard of it until I went to the seminar on the High Piedmont or Alto Piedmont. And so to me, I think it's a very small production winery.
All right, let's try the IOPPA first. Jake, will you help us and pour the bottle? Pour Laura, pour me. Vitor, David, can you come in and help us drink these wines? All right, so this is the IOPPA. This is, it's got that, we'll talk about the characteristics in a second.
I think it's important to drink, you know, still rosé, current vintage. And, I mean, of course, some rosés age, but for our listeners, if
what's
you do,
the vintage year on this?
2016, so it's
2016.
It's brand new, fresh.
It's got a sort of a pale salmon color, right?
Exactly.
Tell me about the nose. What do we get on the nose?
It's more of a, you know,
it's a little
red
restrained,
fruit.
Mm-hmm. But
yeah, if it is, it's like crushed or soft, like red fruit, like cherries and cranberries and a little raspberry. So more on the sour side of red fruit, but it has a floral nose to it as well.
All right, let's throw it over the tongue. It's got nice acidity.
It's bright and fresh.
It's bright. It's got a medium mouthfeel. It's mm-hmm. not unctuous. It's not thin.
No, yeah.
It's mouth coating.
I like the texture of it. I mean, I think
it has a nice
for
texture.
Rosé, what makes the difference between one and the other is this is definitely lip smacking, like you said.
It is lip smacking.
It's like watermelon,
it gets your,
sour.
Yeah.
But the texture is so silky. Like it has just like this, not glycerol, like sweetness, but it has like this very
it's a terrific
smooth rosé style.
Let's talk about food pairings with this. This is pretty diverse.
I'm staring at Roberta's pizza and saying, rosé and pizza are my two favorite things.
Is rosé a good, this particular one?
I mean,
one?
So good. You think about the texture of cheese and, you know, just a simple pie.
Everything.
But, I mean, if we're in summer and we're grilling chicken or we're having a little bit of, like, fried, you know, almost like Frito Misto. You can imagine that this is a really good Frito
It'll
Misto.
Hold up to the fried foods and all that.
Yeah.
Calamari,
it's a great
whatever.
Cocktail party wine.
Yeah. All right. So let's just give me the vitals on this. So it's IOPPA, I-O-P-P-A.
Yes.
It is
all
the
Nebbiolo.
All Nebbiolo. It's the IOPPA Rosé.
Yes.
It's available at good
I would say, yeah. You,
wine stores. Mm-hmm. Not everywhere, but you could probably get online. In New York, it wouldn't be hard.
Right.
Give me retail range.
I think it's probably $15 or less.
So this falls under my...
This is our list wine.
You know what? I may have to add a category. Red, white,
rosé.
This is a good one. All right. So thank you for bringing this in. This is really a terrific wine.
Thanks.
I know why you brought it. All right. Now we're going to move to a little sparkler. We're going to try the Schramsberg rosé champagne. So we're going sort of with the orange category tonight.
So we were both like-minded. We thought about bringing
Jake,
the
pour
spring
Laura
weather
first. Don't worry about that. So this is a pale,
kind of that same salmon color that we were saying on the Iopa, but it's a little bit lighter.
It is almost a little lighter. The color on the Iopa is beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. So we look at this 2009. So
that's
it has
great
a little bottle age, not too much. Let's look at the wine first. So we said it's a little pale, pale salmon. Do you, as an expert, when you look at the bubbles, can you tell too big, too small, overcarbonated? I mean, does this look right?
This is perfect. But, I mean, I wouldn't say that most of, like, our fine, bubbly wines, they have similar mousse or similar bubbles. But, you know, obviously, if it's, like, something that's carbonated and they inject CO2, then it would be
it's
a little
really
inferior.
A little wild, yeah.
Yeah, this looks like classic style.
All right, so let's go nose first.
I mean, I think you really see that this is a 2009 vintage, which thank you for bringing. It's my MS vintage, so
is
thank
it?
You.
Oh,
yeah,
that's right.
So that's very nice.
But, I meant to meet up with you that week, but I got busy and forgot.
Ah, right.
So here we are.
Thank you.
All right, so 09, pretty good year in Napa. I remember that.
Absolutely.
What are we getting on the nose?
This is showing really developed, right, but still fresh. So it has mushrooms. It has like that sort of custard, almost like when right? You get like this, like yogurt, lemon yogurt, but
pretty complex.
Oh, it's so good.
All right. So let's throw it over the tongue. Let's go mouthfeel first for champagne.
For champagne, this doesn't drink like it has any age. It's drinking fresher
it's
than
young,
the nose.
Fresh and vibrant.
Yeah. So the texture is just like that clean, like really refreshing at the ends, just very, very, very young tasting. I would never guess 2009. So that's a good thing because we don't want our wines to necessarily taste old, even though the aroma makes you want to go back to it and keep drinking it.
And I don't want to diss Schramsberg. I'm a fan, the 09 vintage. But I don't know if this is a wine at the price point that you'd buy and hold for 25, 30 years.
No, but
7 years later, it's very vibrant and fresh. All right, so give me some palate descriptors. What are you getting there?
So that little bit of mushroom, that little bit of like dried fruit instead of fresh fruit.
When you say dried fruits, can you point to a specific fruit?
Yes. So I just had in my yogurt this morning dried cranberries, and this reminds me of that.
There's
dried
that tartness. Cranberries. And
there's tart, but it's like shriveled up red fruit. So even like an overripe strawberry, but it has to be like dried out. You think about fruit roll-ups, you know, like those dried red fruits.
All right, now pairing this much different than the Iopa. I mean, does this have what do you do with this?
You can be more serious with the food pairings for this. So I immediately started thinking about this juicy burger. And, you know, we have
this would go good with a juicy burger?
Oh, gosh.
The blood running down your arm?
Yeah, you know.
The champagne in the other hand?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I had this burger with, like, a red wine fondue and bacon and mushrooms. And I'm like, this is the perfect wine for that.
What else? So burger, that's a good one.
You know, anything that has that earthy tone but still is a lighter dish. So if you had, you know, raviolis with, let's say, dry, or, you know, mushrooms.
Like a brown sauce
mushrooms. This is perfect.
Yeah, those are good ones. So let's talk about the two wines. We like them both, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think they're both terrific wines. I'm more than pleasantly surprised on the Iopa. I think for $15-$20, whatever.
So good.
It's a spectacular wine. It's diverse. I think the Schramsberg, you know, you're the sparkling wine expert. For a California rosé, it's fun.
So good.
Great color. It's delicious. It's versatile. And it's, you know, like I said, it's $25-$35, depending
on
how you get close to the vintage. All right. I want to thank you for bringing that in.
Thank you.
And we're going to wrap up. If you have a question, a wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook, The Grape Nation, Instagram @sbenruby, and Twitter @benruby, no S. And we want to thank our guest, Laura Manick. I got it right, finally. Proprietor of Cork Buzz Wine restaurant and studio, Cork Buzz Wine Studio, Cork Buzz Restaurant, Cork Buzz.
Just call us. Don't worry.
There's right. Cork Buzz. There's two in New York City. There's one on 13th Street right by Union Square. There's one in the very busy, terrific Chelsea Market. And in Charlotte, is it a neighborhood, downtown area? What would
it's
you call it?
It's called South Park.
South Park.
Yeah, we're right behind the Whole Foods in South Park.
Now, you told me something earlier. I don't know if you could tell me on air.
Absolutely.
Can you mention that?
Tomorrow, we're opening a new retail wine shop in Charlotte called The Cellar at Cork Buzz. So The Cellar at Cork Buzz is all the handles on Instagram and Twitter, but it's a small...
curated.
Exactly. Small curated wine shop and wine bar, which is inspired by the wine bars in Paris.
So that's the type of place you would find an IOPA in,
exactly.
In Charlotte. If people want to know more about Cork Buzz, give me a handle, corkbuzz.com?
So it's corkbuzz.com and at corkbuzz on Instagram and on Twitter, and at Laura Manick on all of those handles
okay.
as well.
Okay, M-A-N-I-E-C.
Yes.
Right? All right, so you got all the handles to know everything you want. Check it out. If you live in New York or you're in the area, check her classes out. Come in and try some stuff. If you're in Charlotte, you know, stop by. So I want to thank you again, Laura. Thank you to our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you have been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.